This episode is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hello, and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, May 13th, 1985, in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Police Department dropped 2 1-pound bombs onto a row house in West Philadelphia, where police had been in a standoff with members of MOVE, a Black liberation group. The bombing of the row house quickly led to a fire, which spread across 2 city blocks and raged for a couple hours before the fire department finally intervened. In the end, 5 children and 6 adults were killed and 61 homes burned to the ground. So here to discuss the MOVE bombing are, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter-Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hey, Jody.
Hey there.
And our special guest for this episode is Gene Demby, co-host of NPR's Code Switch podcast, a Philadelphia native and someone who has talked about and covered the MOVE bombing for a long time. Someone we've been trying to get on the show for a long time or wanting to have on the show.
Stop.
Gene, seriously, we have this list of possible guests and your name has been on there since day one. And I'm finally glad we got a chance to have you on.
So I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for doing this. And so we'll talk about the MOVE bombing and then we'll do like 6 to 8 minutes at the end on the Philadelphia 76ers and the current season. And the
only 6 to 8 minutes.
Equal time. But,
exactly. So, look, I want to get to MOVE and the organization, but I think we have to start with the bombing itself. So, Gene, the Philadelphia PD owns a helicopter and owns bombs, and they can drop them on a building.
I mean, the details of the bombing are so like head spinning. You know, like every time you sort of like dig into what happened that day, you're like, why was this? You know, this law enforcement response. It's like, why was it so ludicrously, you know, well-armed, right? We talk about militarization of police today, but like, you know, 500 police officers showed up on the scene in this like, you know, middle-class Black neighborhood in West Philly with flak jackets and SWAT gear and 60 caliber machine guns and an anti-tank machine gun, and the state police sent a helicopter and they had bombs. Like, why would they have all this stuff? Yeah. And just to sort of like zoom out a little bit, like 62nd and Osage, if you've never been to Philly, it's just like a regular working class, middle class Black neighborhood in West Philly, right? There's nothing about it that sort of makes it stand out at all, right? It's a narrow block, like so many Philly blocks, really narrow, full of row homes. And the MOVE group had set up a compound in one of those homes. They sort of added things onto it, like a lookout nest. And so on May 13th, 1985, it was kind of this like culmination mm-hmm. of tensions between MOVE, this group, and the police, and MOVE and the neighbors, right, who had been complaining about MOVE, you know, these Black middle class neighbors who were like right, who were adjacent and across the street with MOVE, who they were like always sort of fighting with. It was this sort of weird situation in which these Black middle class neighbors were calling the cops all the time on this group, right, across the street from them, even though obviously these Black folks had like complicated feelings about the police themselves. So on May 13, 1985, after like sort of years of of violent confrontations between MOVE and the city of Philadelphia and the police department of Philadelphia, the police department descends on this block. They shut off all the water, right, and electricity, basically trying to force MOVE out. And they, it's really like the details are sort of stunning because again, this is like a residential block. Once things start to escalate, when they're sort of yelling at the MOVE members over the megaphones, you know, Gregor Sambor, the police commissioner at the time, was like yelling into a megaphone, "Attention, MOVE, this is America. You have to abide by the laws of the United States." MOVE starts shooting at the police from inside this block, again, on this narrow city block inside of this house. And the police department returns like 10,000 rounds of ammunition. Over the next 90 minutes, they just start shooting into this into the city block, into this house. And so it's just like this sort of really like heavy handed response. And All this, by the way, is happening on live television, right? Like, there are local news crews who are like have broken into their broadcast to like show you what's happening. They're sort of just outside the frame. You can hear the gunshots. And so as this sort of siege unfolds over the course of the day, and this was like one of the big controversies of the day, was who gave the order to drop this bomb. So the state police helicopter has been circling as the day goes on and on. The state police helicopter has been circling the scene, and someone gives the order to drop a bomb on the compound, like a firebomb. But again, this is Philadelphia. Like, the houses are, there's no space between the houses. When they drop the bomb on this house, on this sort of this lookout nest, the house quickly catches on the fire. But it's literally sharing walls with, you know, houses on either side. And so those houses catch fire. And within a couple, like by the end of the day, the entire block is on fire. And these are narrow Philly blocks. So the fire is like leaping across the street and setting houses across the street on fire. I mean, it's just like a complete catastrophe. And again, it's all happening on live television. Yeah. By the end of the day, 11 people who lived on Osage Avenue in the MOVE compound had died, including 5 children. And, you know, it was a long time before the police could even identify who they were.
It's an absolutely shocking story. And I think that the two things that stand out, besides the fact that the police are bombing this neighborhood, is how much it really does resemble war. And by that, I mean not just the bombing, which feels sort of like ripped straight out of the Vietnam War and the imagery that we see there, but that claim through the megaphone, "This is America," as though I feel like that must give us some insight into what the police were thinking, that they felt the need to declare, "This is America, you have to follow the laws of the United States," that they saw this group as somehow threatening the sovereignty of the country, and that's why they had to bring all this firepower against it.
You know, as a historical note, like, this is interesting to me because if you think about the amount of times that the United States has dropped bombs on itself, it's always involved black people. So if you think about Tulsa, Oklahoma, and firebombing, you know, Greenwood, and then you think about, you know, Philadelphia, the commonality is black bodies and black humanity. It's just completely rendered like un-American, unhuman, in that you would never imagine that they would do this in any other community and have so little regard for the neighboring people around them. It didn't matter like who was at home during the time. It's even before the bombing, you know, bullet holes have to be shooting through neighboring houses at the same time.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, they were going after MOVE, right? And even if you were sympathetic to the police here, like, you'd almost have to, given like the geography of this block, you would have to, the response would have to be like really restrained in order to do the thing they wanted to do. But there's no way to do, like, I mean, like, these houses are right on top of each other. I mean, by the time the fire was extinguished, you know, 61 homes were completely gone.
Yeah.
You know, 250 people were homeless. Mm. And that's to say nothing of, you know, the 11 people and 5 children who died in the fire. I mean, it really is a sort of bizarre, like, calamity in the history of the United States. And also, like, one of the things that was so compelling to me about, like, revisiting it as an adult, because I was really young when this happened, was just the fact that, like, it sort of just receded from everyone's memory, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it was, like, how could something like this, so, like, catastrophic, happen with, you know, the whole city watching, right?
Yeah.
And it be a thing that is not part of the story that the city and the country tells about
it. It's like Waco, but in a city on live TV.
In a city.
Right? And and then memory hold. But, you know, I think, Gene, to your point about the kind of like tactics, or, you know, we've all sort of talked about this, but the way the police saw MOVE is one thing, but the tactics that they employed clearly indicate that they also didn't see the neighborhood as a real neighborhood, right? You would never take on that level of militarization if you stopped for a second to think about the implications for the other people in the neighborhood and how close the buildings are and so forth. And so I think there's, you know, not just a lack of humanity in approaching MOVE, but just a lack of humanity in just real, and just thinking of a black neighborhood as an actual neighbor where citizens live, and to bring this kind of response into that community is something else entirely.
And it's one of the things that sort of really stuck with me about this story is, you know, MOVE is like sort of this grotesque of a lot of black community police relations, right? Like, so much of police responses to, you know, historically to Black people's, you know, entreaties for like, we need y'all to come in here and like help us keep this community safe, right? Has often resulted in this sort of like heavy-handed responses in which the police are not making, to your point, like not making distinctions between quote unquote the bad guys and the residents, right? Mm-hmm. That happens all the time, right? So it's one of the sort of consistent realities of like policing in Black neighborhoods is that there are, you can find Black people who like call upon the police, right, to theoretically protect them from all these things. And what ends up happening is the police response is often counterproductive and violent, right? Mm-hmm. And MOVE is sort of like an extreme version of this thing we see all the time.
What to me is also so crazy is that they brought in an army for basic, now I won't even say 13 people because nearly half of them are children. Right. So you're talking right. about 500 people for five or six adults. That to me is just astounding. And the fact that there are any survivors, of which there are two, but the fact there are any survivors is also incredible considering the amount of violence that's taking place.
Right. I mean, it is kind of miraculous that Ramona Africa and Birdie Africa, the young boy who survived, is kind of remarkable. If you just like look at the scene, if you look at the photos of what happened, that they got out. Yeah, obviously, like it was just a completely like disproportionate response
to what is essentially, well, tell me if this is a fair correct, but you know, effectively like a noise complaint, like a neighborhood dispute about a group of people living in a house and leaving trash out, or but, you know, like quality of life complaints essentially, or was there something deeper going on there too?
Well, and so this is the thing, that this is why MOVE is so sort of like, I think what's really fascinating is like it's a noise complaint, but like if the people you were complaining against were walking around with like shotguns, right? Like so like the people on the block, you know, this is like a, you know, I spoke to one of the residents who was there when it happened, who was still there, you know, 30 years later, like fighting with the city to sort of make him whole again. But one of the residents on the block was sort of saying like, look, like we would be, at all hours of the night, people at MOVE will be on megaphones from both atop the sort of compound or walking down the block, just yelling and cursing, right? Like into a megaphone, people couldn't sleep, right? It would be the Christmas day and people were like with their families and there would be people cursing and yelling and just sort of, you know, going on these like long political like tirades, like all hours of the day or night. And also they were like on top of the roof with shotguns and like, you know, and like assault rifles, right? And so the complaints that they were making to MOVE were always like, MOVE was incredibly intimidating. And MOVE was like this really, people didn't know what to do with them. Like they'd had a previous residence before they ended up at 62nd and Osage, and they were sort of driven out of that neighborhood. MOVE sort of occupied this very weird space in the like political sort of structure of like Black Radical Philadelphia, right? Like they had this weird sort of like back to earth Rastafarian, like Pan-African sort of syncretic belief system. So they, even the other Black radical groups are like, what is up with these cats? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what are they doing? But at the same time, like what people kept telling me was like, because MOVE was such an obvious, like, you know, provocative target, they often found themselves sort of like having to support MOVE because they were like, look, if the police were coming up and harassing MOVE as they move about the city, they can eventually, they'll turn their attention to us. Mm. Right. And so even though we don't like know what's up with these dudes, with these people, like we still share similar concerns with them about policing in Philadelphia. And so what you have is like these like, you know, middle class, you know, like Black folks across the street from this group of people who like, you know, were like legitimately kind of scary, right? Like they were like throwing trash off the roof, and the MOVE folks were vegetarian, so they're throwing like, you know, banana peels and like, you know, also like plant detritus, like food detritus out of their house. And it is a quality of life complaint, but like, you know, like you also can understand why they would be like a little shook. Like, I mean, I'm gonna ask you very forcefully to pick up your trash, and then you sort of like tap your shotgun, and I'm like, yeah, all right, you know what I mean?
Maybe, you can leave maybe, it there.
You know. We're good.
Yeah,
we're
exactly.
Good.
Like, exactly. And so, again, this is like, it gets to this thing about, like, okay, so you don't have a lot of options to resolve this conflict, and so you call the police. And the people on the block have been sort of calling the police for a long time on MOVE. Yeah. And so there was like frustration in like all these directions, right? And so, like, there was, you know, a real sense of like, there seemed to be a sense from the people I talked to that there's a real sense of like, if the police get involved, like, this could get ugly. But I don't think anybody thought it would become like what it became.
Nobody thought they would drop bombs. Nobody thought that. And even when fire started, no one thought that they would not put it out or delay putting it out.
And that's one of the things that like comes up again, like in the hearings after everything goes down, is like there's a whole argument or sort of like why wasn't the fire put out, right? There's this really infamous line, what some high ranking police official said, let the fire burn. Like once the fire sort of like becomes this conflagration and there's a chance to sort of get it under control at the early stages, they actively decide not to, right? The shooting of 10,000 rounds of ammunition was a conscious choice. The bombing was a conscious choice. And the decision to let the fire burn uncontrolled was another like conscious decision. And, you know, no one had to answer for any of those decisions.
Mm. Yeah, that I think is so important, that this isn't a moment, this isn't a thing where stuff incrementally got further and further out of control. I mean, it seemed like the police showed up ready to just escalate by several orders of magnitude.
Absolutely.
And that's what happened. Nikki, you want to?
Yeah, I'm just so struck by, you know, Jody, you mentioned earlier Waco in 93, and I would add Ruby Ridge in 92. And I mean, mm-hmm. both of these are cases where law enforcement did too much. But the response to it by political actors, by activists, is just so different. Like Ruby Ridge and Waco become these watchwords. Congress has mm-hmm. militias come and testify after the Oklahoma City bombing because they want to understand, you know, what has driven people to this point. And MOVE, as you were saying earlier, Jean, it gets kind of memory hold mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, where I think it's just recently that kind of in a national conversation that it's actually getting some more attention, and the disparity between the reaction and the remembering and the response to all of this is, it's very telling.
Yeah. And I mean, that's like one of the things that's so puzzling about this story is like why it gets, as you said, memory hold, right? And I mean, part of it is obviously like the victims of the MOVE bombing were Black, right? That's obviously a huge part of the story and why it gets memory hold. But also I think it's like it has a lot to do with like our broader relationship with policing. You know what I mean? Like there is so much credibility extended to police all the time, right? This is like, oh, the police overstepped, but they're generally really good, mm-hmm. right? Like there was no consequences for the Philadelphia Police Department, right? I mean, except for the communities in which they were already sort of viewed skeptically. It didn't seem like there was any sort of real dent in their credibility, right? Like nobody went to jail for this. No one was punished or even like reprimanded for it formally, right? Had anybody suffered any consequences? The only people who saw went to jail in the MOVE bombing was like Ramona mm-hmm. Africa, right? Like she was like one of the survivors. But also like the Philadelphia Police Department had been violating Black people's rights in all these ways, like that, and MOVE is like the most extreme example, but they've been so antagonistic to Black Philadelphians for so long that they created, I think, a kind of like framework around, like a framework for impunity, mm. right? A sort of like larger conceptual sort of like space in which like all these things were inbound. You know what I mean? Like it was, this is the kind of things that were like open, just like regular practices in Philly with the police department.
You know, it's interesting that the only person you had mentioned before that goes to prison is Ramona Africa. She served 7 years. After she gets mm-hmm. out, you know, she sues and wins about $1.5 million in a civil suit. But if you think about that, that's no money for the kind of harm that was caused. Also, the other residents who lost their homes as a result of the bombing also sued the city. And they're awarded about $12.83 million, which is still, again, a small price to pay for the amount mm-hmm. of damage and harm that was caused. And then, you know, recently it's been in the news as well that the remains of two of the children who died in the house were being used by the University of Pennsylvania. And I mean, you want to mm-hmm. talk about causing, you know, additional harm and injury and just sort of the insidious nature of all of this. These are not the remains of, like, you know, children in the Ice Age, right? This is like, you know, Black children. Yeah. Who it's not clear why the remains were used, how they were used,
right.
Where their remains are now. Princeton was also had a role in this as well. So it's just baffling that the violence really continued even after death to mm-hmm. to this community.
It's you know, I got to speak to Ramona Africa. She seemed like somebody that would have went to like my church, you know what I mean? Which I was surprised by. But she talked a lot about like the sort of ongoing trauma of it, right? Like, and I just kept thinking about like this like giant scar that like exists, you know, for her. And there's no way to sort of like, if you believe in closure, like there's no way she could get closure. But also like the fact that, you know, the people, these children, weren't given like proper burials. I mean, it didn't even dawn on me at the time to ask like what happened to the remains of the people in the bombing, because you would just assume that they would have been treated with like just a baseline of like dignity, right? Like, but the fact that they were, you know, being used at this enormously wealthy institution in West Philly at the University of Pennsylvania, right? Like, for this sort of like almost like in this weird anthropological way, right? Like this sort of like weird dehumanizing. There are all these indignities stacked on top of indignities, right?
You use that word scar, and you know, we've been talking about the emotional scars and the political scars. I'm curious, as we start to wrap up, I mean, if you go to the 6200 block of Osage Avenue, are there physical scars? Is there an indication of what happened in 1985?
Yeah, I mean, when we were there a couple of years ago, the city had done this thing where they had tried to like rebuild. Obviously, they had to rebuild the block, right? And so you had these sort of weird cookie cutter houses that were empty. They were vacant on the block because the city threw them up to try to, you know, make this block livable again. But of course, like, it turned out that the buildings weren't up to code, right? And so the city threw them up and people really immediately realized that they couldn't live in them. But the other half of the block was just these, I mean, it's weird to say like a block is a ghost town, but like you have one half of the block that is inhabited, but the other half of the block, the eastern half of the block, was just like these houses that they were boarded up, you know? They were just like, they look like they've been frozen in time from like, you know, the early 90s. I mean, again, I cannot emphasize, like, it is an unremarkable block in Philadelphia. You know what I mean? Like, it is, like, it looks like a regular-ass block you could find in any other part of the city. It's just really jarring to think about, like, a regular block, regular narrow Philly block with, like, corner stores in the neighborhood and people just sort of walking around and, you know, like, watering the flowers in their little pots outside their houses. And then, like, this giant sort of hole, sort of psychic hole on the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Gene and all of us are doing a very good job of painting the picture here, but this is one of those where I encourage people to go and just search for images, because it is just hard to believe when you actually look at the pictures of the block and the bombing and the aftermath and so forth. So let's leave it there. Gene Demby, thank you so much for doing this. Co-host of Code Switch, the fantastic podcast, and Philadelphia native. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you.
And Nicole Hammer, thanks to you.
Thanks, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. You can get in touch with us with any questions or comments or ideas for the show. Email us thisdaypod@gmail.com, or you can find a form at thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Let's take a careful look at this. 5:27 p.m. State Police helicopter drops it. There is the explosion. As you can see, a very dramatic explosion that occurs 30 seconds and really rips into the MOVE compound. There you see the bunker, which soon will go up in flames.
Radiotopia.